practically an unlimited amount of ice cream sodas. Suddenly the man by the door got up and went out. That surprised me. If he was going to wait outside, why not wait outside from the beginning? I slipped down from my stool and went cautiously to the door. I drew back quickly into the shadow. The man was talking to Guy Padgett. If I had ever had any doubts, that would have settled it. Padgett had his watch out and was looking at it. They exchanged a few brief words, and then the secretary swung on down the street towards the station. Evidently, he had given his orders. But what were they? Suddenly my heart leapt into my mouth. The man who had followed me crossed to the middle of the road and spoke to a policeman. He spoke at some length, gesticulating towards Cartwright's and evidently explaining something. I saw the plan at once. I was to be arrested on some charge or other, pocket-picking, perhaps. It would be easy enough for the gang to put through a simple little matter like that. Of what good to protest my innocence? They would have seen to every detail. Long ago they had brought a charge of robbing De Beers against Harry Raeburn, and he had not been able to disprove it, though I had little doubt that he had been absolutely blameless. What chance had I against such a frame-up as the Colonel could devise? I glanced up at the clock almost mechanically, and immediately another aspect of the case struck me. I saw the point of Guy Padgett's looking at his watch. It was just on 11, and at 11 the mail train left for Rhodesia, bearing with it the influential friends who might otherwise come to my rescue. That was the reason of my immunity up to now. From last night till 11 this morning, I had been safe, but now the net was closing in upon me. I hurriedly opened my bag and paid for my drinks, and as I did so, my heart seemed to stand still. For inside it was a man's wallet stuffed with notes. It must have been deftly introduced into my handbag as I left the tram. Promptly I lost my head. I hurried out of Cartwright's. The little man with the big nose and the policeman were just crossing the road. They saw me, and the little man designated me excitedly to the policeman. I took to my heels and ran. I judged him to be a slow policeman. I should get a start. But I had no plan, even then. I just ran for my life down Adderley Street. People began to stare. I felt that in another minute someone would stop me. An idea flashed into my head. "The station?" I asked in a breathless gasp. "Just down on the right." I sped on. It is permissible to run for a train. I turned into the station, but as I did so I heard footsteps close behind me. The little man with the big nose was a champion sprinter. I foresaw that I should be stopped before I got to the platform I was in search of. I looked up at the clock. 1 minute to 11. I might just do it if my plan succeeded. I had entered the station by the main entrance in Adderley Street. I now darted out again through the side exit. Directly opposite me was a side entrance to the post office, the main entrance to which is in Adderley Street. As I expected, my pursuer, instead of following me in, ran down the street to cut me off when I emerged by the main entrance, or to warn the policeman to do so. In an instant, I slipped across the street again and back into the station. I ran like a lunatic. It was just 11. The long train was moving as I appeared on the platform. A porter tried to stop me, but I wriggled myself out of his grasp and sprang upon the footboard. I mounted the two steps and opened the gate. I was safe. The train was gathering way. We passed a man standing by himself at the end of the platform. I waved to him. "Goodbye, Mr. Padgett," I shouted. Never have I seen a man more taken aback. He looked as though he had seen a ghost. In a minute or two, I was having trouble with the conductor, but I took a lofty tone. "I am Sir Eustace Pedler's secretary," I said haughtily. "Please take me to his private car." Suzanne and Colonel Race were standing on the rear observation platform. They both uttered an exclamation of utter surprise at seeing me. "Hello, Miss Anne," cried Colonel Race. "Where have you turned up from? I thought you'd gone to Durban. What an unexpected person you are." Suzanne said nothing, but her eyes asked 100 questions. "I must report myself to my chief," I said demurely. "Where is he?" "He's in the office, middle compartment, dictating at an incredible rate to the unfortunate Miss Pettigrew." "This enthusiasm for work is something new," I commented. "Hmm," said Colonel Race. His idea is, I think, to give her sufficient work to chain her to her typewriter in her own compartment for the rest of the day. I laughed. Then, followed by the other two, I sought out Sir Eustace. He was striding up and down the circumscribed space, hurling a flood of words at the unfortunate secretary, whom I now saw for the first time. A tall, square woman in drab clothing, with pince-nez and an efficient air. I judged that she was finding it difficult to keep pace with Sir Eustace, for her pencil was flying along, and she was frowning horribly. I stepped into the compartment. "Come aboard, sir," I said saucily. Sir Eustace paused dead in the middle of a complicated sentence on the labour situation and stared at me. Miss Pettigrew must be a nervous creature, in spite of her efficient air, for she jumped as though she had been shot.
"God bless my soul," ejaculated Sir Eustace. "What about the young man in Durban?"
"I prefer you," I said softly.
"Darling," said Sir Eustace, "you can start holding my hand at once."
Miss Pettigrew coughed, and Sir Eustace hastily withdrew his hand.
"Ah, yes," he said. "Let me see where we are. Yes, Tilman Roos, in his speech at... What's the matter? Why aren't you taking it down?"
"I think," said Colonel Race gently, "that Miss Pettigrew has broken her pencil." He took it from her and sharpened it. Sir Eustace stared, and so did I. There was something in Colonel Race's tone that I did not quite understand. Chapter 22. Extract from the diary of Sir Eustace Pedler.
I am inclined to abandon my reminiscences. Instead, I shall write a short article entitled Secretaries I Have Had. As regards secretaries, I seem to have fallen under a blight. At one minute I have no secretaries, at another I have too many. At the present minute I am journeying to Rhodesia with a pack of women. Race goes off with the two best looking, of course, and leaves me with the dud. That is what always happens to me. And after all, this is my private car, not Race's. Also, Anne Bedingfeld is accompanying me to Rhodesia on the pretext of being my temporary secretary. But all this afternoon she has been out on the observation platform with Race, exclaiming at the beauty of the Hex River Pass. It is true that I told her her principal duty would be to hold my hand. But she isn't even doing that. Perhaps she is afraid of Miss Pettigrew. I don't blame her if so. There is nothing attractive about Miss Pettigrew. She is a repellent female with large feet, more like a man than a woman. There is something very mysterious about Anne Bedingfeld. She jumped on board the train at the last minute, puffing like a steam engine for all the world as though she has been running a race. And yet Paget told me that he'd seen her off to Durban last night. Either Paget has been drinking again, or else the girl must have an astral body. And she never explains. Nobody ever explains. Yes, secretaries I have had. Number one, a murderer fleeing from justice. Number two, a secret drinker who carries on disreputable intrigues in Italy. Number three, a beautiful girl who possesses the useful faculty of being in two places at once. Number four, Miss Pettigrew, who I have no doubt is really a particularly dangerous crook in disguise. Probably one of Paget's Italian friends that he has palmed off on me. I shouldn't wonder if the world found some day that it had been grossly deceived by Paget. On the whole, I think Rayburn was the best of the bunch. He never worried me or got in my way. Guy Paget has had the impertinence to have the stationery trunk put in here. None of us can move without falling over it. I went out on the observation platform just now, expecting my appearance to be greeted with hails of delight. Both the women were listening spellbound to one of Race's traveller's tales. I shall label this car not Sir Eustace Pedler and party, but Colonel Race and Harem. Then Mrs. Blair must needs begin taking silly photographs. Every time we went round a particularly appalling curve, as we climbed higher and higher, she snapped at the engine.
"You see the point,"
she cried delightedly.
"It must be some curve if you can photograph the front part of the train from the back, and with mountain background, it will look awfully dangerous."
I pointed out to her that no one could possibly tell if it had been taken from the back of the train. She looked at me pityingly.
I shall write underneath it, taken from the train, engine going round a curve.
You could write that under any snapshot of a train, I said. Women never think of these simple things.
I'm glad we've come up here in daylight,
cried Anne Bedingfeld.
I shouldn't have seen this if I'd gone last night to Durban, should I?
No, said Colonel Race, smiling. You would have woken up tomorrow morning to find yourself in the Karoo, a hot, dusty desert of stones and rocks.
I'm glad I changed my mind,
said Anne, sighing contentedly and looking round. It was rather a wonderful sight, the great mountains all around, through which we turned and twisted and laboured ever steadily upwards.
Is this the best train in the day to Rhodesia? Asked Anne Bedingfeld.
In the day? Laughed Race. Why, my dear Miss Anne, there are only three trains a week, Mondays, Wednesdays and Saturdays. Do you realise that you don't arrive at the Falls until Saturday next?
How well we shall know each other by that time, said Mrs. Blair maliciously. How long are you going to stay at the Falls, Sir Eustace?
That depends, I said cautiously.
On what?
On how things go at Johannesburg. My original idea was to stay a couple of days at the Falls, which I've never seen, though this is my third visit to Africa, and then go on to Joburg and study the conditions of things on the Rand. At home, you know, I pose as being an authority on South African politics, but from all I hear, Joburg will be a particularly unpleasant place to visit in about a week's time. I don't want to study conditions in the midst of a raging revolution.
Race smiled in a rather superior manner.
I think your fears are exaggerated, Sir Eustace. There'll be no great danger in Joburg. The women immediately looked at him in the "what a brave hero you are" manner. It annoyed me intensely. I am every bit as brave as Race, but I lack the figure. These long, lean, brown men have it all their own way. I suppose you'll be there, I said coldly.
Very possibly. We might travel together.
I'm not sure that I shan't stay on the Falls a bit, I answered noncommittally. Why is Race so anxious that I should go to Joburg? He's got his eye on Anne, I believe. What are your plans, Miss Anne?
That depends,
she replied demurely, copying me. I thought you were my secretary, I objected.
Oh, but I've been cut out. You've been holding Miss Pettigrew's hand all afternoon.
Whatever I am been doing, I can swear I've not been doing that, I assured her. Thursday night. We have just left Kimberley. Race has made to tell the story of the diamond robbery all over again. Why are women so excited by anything to do with diamonds? At last, Anne Bedingfeld has shed her veil of mystery. It seems that she's a newspaper correspondent. She sent an immense cable from DR this morning. To judge by the jabbering that went on nearly all night in Mrs. Blair's cabin, she must have been reading aloud all her special articles for years to come. It seems that all along she's been on the track of the man in the brown suit. Apparently she didn't spot him on the Kilmorden. In fact, she hardly had the chance. But she's now very busy cabling home. How I journeyed out with the murderer and inventing highly fictitious stories of what he said to me, etc. I know how these things are done. I do them myself in my reminiscences when Paget will let me, and of course one of Naseby's efficient staff will brighten up the details still more, so that when it appears in the Daily Budget, Rayburn won't recognise himself. The girl's clever, though. All on her own, apparently, she's ferreted out the identity of the woman who was killed in my house. She was a Russian dancer called Nadina. I asked Anne Bedingfeld if she was sure of this. She replied that it was merely a deduction, quite in the Sherlock Holmes manner. However, I gather that she had cabled it home to Naseby as proved fact. Women have these intuitions. I've no doubt that Anne Bedingfeld is perfectly right in her guess, but to call it a deduction is absurd. However she ever got on the staff of the Daily Budget is more than I can imagine, but she is the kind of young woman who does these things. Impossible to withstand her. She's full of coaxing ways that mask an invincible determination. Look how she has got into my private car. I'm beginning to have an inkling why. Race said something about the police suspecting that Rayburn would make for Rhodesia. He might just have got off by Monday's train. They telegraphed all along the line, I presume, and no one of his description was found. But that says little. He's an astute young man, and he knows Africa. He's probably exquisitely disguised as an old Kaffir woman, and the simple police continue to look for a handsome young man with a scar, dressed in the height of European fashion. I never did quite swallow that scar. Anyway, Anne Bedingfeld is on his track. She wants the glory of discovering him for herself, and the Daily Budget. Young women are very cold-blooded nowadays. I hinted to her that it was an unwomanly action. She laughed at me. She assured me that did she run him to earth, her fortune was made. Race doesn't like it either, I can see. Perhaps Rayburn is on this train. If so, we may all be murdered in our beds. I said so to Mrs. Blair, but she seemed quite to welcome the idea and remarked that if I were murdered, it would be a terrific scoop for Anne. A scoop for Anne, indeed. Tomorrow we shall be going through Bechuanaland. The dust will be atrocious. Also, at every station, little Kaffir children come and sell you quaint wooden animals that they carve themselves. Also mealy bowls and baskets. I'm rather afraid that Mrs. Blair may run amok. There is a primitive charm about these toys that I feel will appeal to her. Friday evening. As I feared, Mrs. Blair and Anne have bought 49 wooden animals.
Chapter 23. Anne's narrative resumed. I thoroughly enjoyed the journey up to Rhodesia. There was something new and exciting to see every day. First, the wonderful scenery of the Hex River Valley, then the desolate grandeur of the Karoo, and finally, that wonderful straight stretch of line in Bechuanaland, and the perfectly adorable toys the natives brought to sell. Suzanne and I were nearly left behind at each station, if you could call them stations. It seemed to me that the train just stopped whenever it felt like it, and no sooner had it done so than a horde of natives materialized out of the empty landscape, holding up mealy bowls and sugar canes and fur carooses and adorable carved wooden animals. Suzanne began at once to make a collection of the latter. I imitated her example. Most of them cost a tiki, threepence, and each was different. There were giraffes and tigers and snakes, and a melancholy-looking eland, and absurd little black warriors. We enjoyed ourselves enormously. Sir Eustace tried to restrain us, but in vain. I still think it was a miracle we were not left behind at some oasis of the line. South African trains don't hoot or get excited when they're going to start off again. They just glide quietly away, and you look up from your bargaining and run for your life. Suzanne's amazement at seeing me climb upon the train at Cape Town can be imagined. We held an exhaustive survey of the situation on the first evening out. We talked half the night. It had become clear to me that defensive tactics must be adopted as well as aggressive ones. Travelling with Sir Eustace Pedler and his party, I was fairly safe. Both he and Colonel Race were powerful protectors, and I judged that my enemies would not wish to stir up a hornet's nest about my ears. Also, as long as I was near Sir Eustace, I was more or less in touch with Guy Paget, and Guy Paget was the heart of the mystery. I asked Suzanne whether, in her opinion, it was possible that Paget himself was the mysterious colonel. His subordinate position was, of course, against the assumption, but it had struck me once or twice that, for all his autocratic ways, Sir Eustace was really very much influenced by his secretary. He was an easygoing man, and one whom an adroit secretary might be able to twist round his little finger. The comparative obscurity of his position might in reality be useful to him, since he would be anxious to be well out of the limelight. Suzanne, however, negatived these ideas very strongly. She refused to believe that Guy Paget was the ruling spirit. The real head, the colonel, was somewhere in the background and had probably been already in Africa at the time of our arrival. I agreed that there was much to be said for her view, but I was not entirely satisfied. for in each suspicious instance, Paget had been shown as the directing genius. It was true that his personality seemed to lack the assurance and decision that one would expect from a master criminal. But after all, according to Colonel Race, it was brain work only that this mysterious leader supplied, and creative genius is often allied to a weak and timorous physical constitution.
"There speaks the professor's daughter," interrupted Suzanne, when I had got to this point in my argument.
"It's true all the same. On the other hand, Paget may be the Grand Vizier, so to speak, of the All Highest." I was silent for a minute or two, and then went on musingly. "I wish I knew how Sir Eustace made his money."
"Suspecting him again? Suzanne, I've got into that state that I can't help suspecting somebody."
"I don't really suspect him, but after all, he is Paget's employer, and he did own the mill house."
"I've always heard that he made his money in some way he isn't anxious to talk about," said Suzanne thoughtfully. "But that doesn't necessarily mean crime. It might be tin tacks or hair restorer."
I agreed ruthfully.
"I suppose," said Suzanne doubtfully, "that we're not barking up the wrong tree. Being led completely astray, I mean, by assuming Paget's complicity. Supposing that, after all, he is a perfectly honest man."
I considered that for a minute or two. Then I shook my head.
"I can't believe that. After all, he has his explanations for everything."
"Yes, but they're not very convincing. For instance, the night he tried to throw me overboard on the Kilmorden, he says he followed Rayburn up on deck, and Rayburn turned and knocked him down. Now, we know that's not true."
"No," said Suzanne unwillingly, "but we only heard the story at second hand from Sir Eustace. If we'd heard it direct from Paget himself, it might have been different. You know how people always get a story a little wrong when they repeat it?"
I turned the thing over in my mind. "No," I said at last, "I don't see any way out. Paget's guilty. You can't get away from the fact that he tried to throw me overboard, and everything else fits in."
"Why are you so persistent in this new idea of yours?"
"Because of his face."
"His face? But..."
"Yes, I know what you're going to say. It's a sinister face. That's just it. No man with a face like that could be really sinister. It must be a colossal joke on the part of nature."
I did not believe much in Suzanne's argument. I know a lot about nature in past ages. If she's got a sense of humour, she doesn't show it much. Suzanne is just the sort of person who would clothe nature with all her own attributes. We passed on to discuss our immediate plans. It was clear to me that I must have some kind of standing. I couldn't go on avoiding explanations forever. The solution of all my difficulties lay ready to my hand, though I didn't think of it for some time. The Daily Budget. My silence or my speech could no longer affect Harry Rayburn. He was marked down as the man in the brown suit through no fault of mine. I could help him best by seeming to be against him. The Colonel and his gang must have no suspicion that there existed any friendly feeling between me and the man they had elected to be the scapegoat of the murder at Marlowe. As far as I knew, the woman killed was still unidentified. I would cable to Lord Naseby, suggesting that she was no other than the famous Russian dancer Nadina, who had been delighting Paris for so long. It seemed incredible to me that she had not been identified already, but when I learnt more of the case long afterwards, I saw how natural it really was. Nadina had never been to England during her successful career in Paris. She was unknown to London audiences. The pictures in the papers of the Marlowe victim were so blurred and unrecognisable that it is small wonder no one identified them. And on the other hand, Nadina had kept her intention of visiting England a profound secret from everyone. The day after the murder, a letter had been received by her manager purporting to be from the dancer, in which she said that she was returning to Russia on urgent private affairs, and that he must deal with her broken contract as best he could. All this, of course, I only learned afterwards. With Suzanne's full approval, I sent a long cable from De R. It arrived at a psychological moment. This again, of course, I learnt afterwards. The Daily Budget was hard up for a sensation. My guess was verified and proved to be correct, and the Daily Budget had the scoop of its lifetime. Victim of the Millhouse murder, identified by our special reporter, and so on. Our reporter makes voyage with the murderer, the man in the brown suit. What is he really like? The main facts were, of course, cabled to the South African papers, but I only read my own lengthy articles at a much later date. I received approval and full instructions by cable at Bulawayo. I was on the staff of the Daily Budget, and I had a private word of congratulation from Lord Naseby himself. I was definitely accredited to hunt down the murderer, and I, and only I, knew that the murderer was not Harry Raeburn. But let the world think that it was he. Best so for the present. Chapter 24. We arrived at Bulawayo early on Saturday morning. I was disappointed in the place. It was very hot and I hated the hotel. Also, Sir Eustace was what I can only describe as thoroughly sulky. I think it was all our wooden animals that annoyed him, especially the big giraffe. It was a colossal giraffe with an impossible neck, a mild eye and a dejected tail. It had character. It had charm. A controversy was already arising as to whom it belonged to, me or Suzanne. We had each contributed a tiki to its purchase. Suzanne advanced the claims of seniority in the married state. I stuck to the position that I had been the first to behold its beauty. In the meantime, I must admit, it occupied a good deal of this three-dimensional space of ours. To carry 49 wooden animals, all of awkward shape, and all of extremely brittle wood, is somewhat of a burden. Two porters were laden with a bunch of animals each, and one promptly dropped a ravishing group of ostriches and broke their heads off. Warned by this, Suzanne and I carried all we could. Colonel Race helped, and I pressed the big giraffe into Sir Eustace's arms. Even the correct Miss Pettigrew did not escape. A large hippopotamus and two black warriors fell to her share. I had a feeling Miss Pettigrew didn't like me. Perhaps she fancied I was a bold hussy. Anyway, she avoided me as much as she could, and the funny thing was, her face seemed vaguely familiar to me, though I couldn't quite place it. We reposed ourselves most of the morning, and in the afternoon we drove out to the Mattapos to see Rhodes's grave. That is to say, we were to have done so, but at the last moment Sir Eustace backed out. He was very nearly in as bad a temper as the morning we arrived at Cape Town, when he bounced the peaches on the floor and they squashed. Evidently arriving early in the morning at places is bad for his temperament. He cursed the porters, he cursed the waiter at breakfast, he cursed the whole hotel management. He would doubtless have liked to curse Miss Pettigrew, who hovered around with her pencil and pad, but I don't think even Sir Eustace would have dared to curse Miss Pettigrew. She's just like the efficient secretary in a book. I only rescued our dear giraffe just in time. I feel Sir Eustace would have liked to dash him to the ground. To return to our expedition. After Sir Eustace had backed out, Miss Pettigrew said she would remain at home in case he might want her. And at the very last minute, Suzanne sent down a message to say she had a headache. So Colonel Race and I drove off alone. He is a strange man. One doesn't notice it so much in a crowd, but when one is alone with him, the sense of his personality seems really almost overpowering. He becomes more taciturn, and yet his silence seems to say more than speech might do. It was so that day when we drove to the Mattapos, through the soft yellow-brown scrub. Everything seemed strangely silent, except our car, which I should think was the first Ford ever made by man. The upholstery of it was torn to ribbons, and though I know nothing about engines, even I could guess that all was not as it should be in its interior. By and by the character of the country changed. Great boulders appeared, piled up into fantastic shapes. I felt suddenly that I had got into a primitive era. Just for a moment, Neanderthal men seemed quite as real to me as they had to Papa. I turned to Colonel Race. There must have been giants once, I said dreamily, and their children were just like children are today.
They played with handfuls of pebbles, piling them up and knocking them down, and the more cleverly they balanced them, the better pleased they were. If I were to give a name to this place, I should call it the Country of Giant Children.
Perhaps you're nearer the mark than you know, said Colonel Race gravely. Simple, primitive, big. That is Africa.
I nodded appreciatively. You love it, don't you? I asked.
Yes, but to live in it long, well, it makes one what you would call cruel. One comes to hold life and death very lightly.
Yes, I said, thinking of Harry Rayburn. He had been like that too, but not cruel to weak things.
Opinions differ as to what are and are not weak things, Miss Anne.
There was a note of seriousness in his voice which almost startled me. I felt that I knew very little really of this man at my side. I meant children and dogs, I think.
I can truthfully say I've never been cruel to children or dogs. So you don't class women as weak things?
I considered. No, I don't think I do. Though they are, I suppose. That is, they are nowadays. But Papa always said that in the beginning, men and women roamed the world together, equal in strength, like lions and tigers.
And giraffes, interpolated Colonel Race slyly.
I laughed. Everyone makes fun of that giraffe. And giraffes. They were nomadic, you see. It wasn't till they settled down in communities and women did one kind of thing and men another that women got weak. And of course, underneath, one is still the same. One feels the same, I mean. And that is why women worship physical strength in men. It's what they once had and have lost.
Almost ancestor worship, in fact.
Something of the kind.
And you really think that's true? That women worship strength, I mean?
I think it's quite true, if one's honest. You think you admire moral qualities, but when you fall in love, you revert to the primitive, where the physical is all that counts. But I don't think that's the end. If you lived in primitive conditions, it would be all right. But you don't. And so, in the end, the other thing wins after all. It's the things that are apparently conquered that always do win, isn't it? They win in the only way that counts. Like what the Bible says about losing your life and finding it.
In the end, said Colonel Race thoughtfully, you fall in love, and you fall out of it. Is that what you mean?
Not exactly, but you can put it that way if you like.
But I don't think you've ever fallen out of love, Miss Anne.
No, I haven't, I admitted frankly.
Or fallen in love either?
I did not answer. The car drew up at our destination and brought the conversation to a close. We got out and began the slow ascent to the world's view. Not for the first time, I felt a slight discomfort in Colonel Race's company. He veiled his thoughts so well behind those impenetrable black eyes. He frightened me a little. He had always frightened me. I never knew where I stood with him. We climbed in silence till we reached the spot where Rhodes lies, guarded by giant boulders. A strange, eerie place, far from the haunts of men, that sings a ceaseless paean of rugged beauty. We sat there for a time in silence, then descended once more, but diverging slightly from the path. Sometimes it was a rough scramble, and once we came to a sharp slope or rock that was almost sheer. Colonel Race went first, then turned to help me.
Better lift you, he said suddenly, and swung me off my feet with a quick gesture.
I felt the strength of him as he set me down and released his clasp. A man of iron, with muscles like taut steel. And again I felt afraid, especially as he did not move aside, but stood directly in front of me, staring into my face.
What are you really doing here, Anne Bedingfeld? He said abruptly.
I'm a gypsy seeing the world.
Yes, that's true enough. The newspaper correspondent is only a pretext. You're not the soul of a journalist. You're out for your own hand, snatching at life. But that's not all.
What was he going to make me tell him? I was afraid. Afraid. I looked him full in the face. My eyes can't keep secrets like his, but they can carry the war into the enemy's country. What are you really doing here, Colonel Race? I asked deliberately.
For a moment, I thought he wasn't going to answer. He was clearly taken aback, though. At last he spoke, and his words seemed to afford him a grim amusement.
"Pursuing ambition,"
he said.
"Just that. Pursuing ambition. You will remember, Miss Bedingfeld, that by that sin fell the angels, etc."
"They say," I said slowly, "that you are really connected with the government, that you are in the Secret Service. Is that true?" Was it my fancy, or did he hesitate for a fraction of a second before he answered,
"I can assure you, Miss Bedingfeld, that I am out here strictly as a private individual travelling for my own pleasure."
Thinking the answer over later, it struck me as slightly ambiguous. Perhaps he meant it to be so. We rejoined the car in silence. Halfway back to Bulawayo, we stopped for tea at a somewhat primitive structure at the side of the road. The proprietor was digging in the garden and seemed annoyed at being disturbed, but he graciously promised to see what he could do. After an interminable wait, he brought us some stale cakes and some lukewarm tea, then disappeared to his garden again. No sooner had he departed than we were surrounded by cats, 6 of them all meowing piteously at once. The racket was deafening. I offered them some pieces of cake. They devoured them ravenously. I poured all the milk there was into the saucer, and they fought each other to get it. "Oh," I cried indignantly, "they're starved. It's wicked. Please, please order some more milk and another plate of cake." Colonel Race departed silently to do my bidding. The cats had begun meowing again. He returned with a big jug of milk, and the cats finished it all. I got up with determination on my face. "I'm going to take those cats home with us. I shan't leave them here."
"My dear child, don't be absurd. You can't carry 6 cats as well as 50 wooden animals round with you."
"Never mind the wooden animals. These cats are alive. I shall take them back with me."
"You will do nothing of the kind." I looked at him resentfully, but he went on. "You think me cruel, but one can't go through life sentimentalizing over these things. It's no good standing out. I shan't allow you to take them. It's a primitive country, you know, and I'm stronger than you."
I always know when I'm beaten. I went down to the car with tears in my eyes.
"They're probably short of food just today," he explained consolingly. "That man's wife has gone into Bulawayo for stores, so it'll be all right. And anyway, you know, the world's full of starving cats."
"Don't, don't," I said fiercely.
"I'm teaching you to realize life as it is. I'm teaching you to be hard and ruthless, like I am. That's the secret of strength, and the secret of success."
"I'd sooner be dead than hard," I said passionately. We got into the car and started off. I pulled myself together again slowly. Suddenly, to my intense astonishment, he took my hand in his.
"Anne," he said gently, "I want you. Will you marry me?"
I was utterly taken aback. "Oh, no," I stammered. I can't."
"Why not?"
"I don't care for you in that way. I've never thought of you like that."
"I see. Is that the only reason?"
I had to be honest. I owed it to him. "No," I said. "It is not. You see, I care for someone else."
"I see," he said again. "And that was true at the beginning, when I first saw you on the Kilmorden."
"No," I whispered. "It was since then."
"I see," he said for the third time.
But this time there was a purposeful ring in his voice that made me turn and look at him. His face was grimmer than I had ever seen it. What do you mean?" I faltered. He looked at me, inscrutable, dominating.
"Only that I know now what I have to do."
His words sent a shiver through me. There was a determination behind them that I did not understand, and it frightened me. We neither of us said any more until we got back to the hotel. I went straight up to Suzanne. She was lying on her bed reading and did not look in the least as though she had a headache. "Here reposes the perfect gooseberry," she remarked, "alias the tactful chaperone." "Why, Anne, dear, what's the matter?" For I had burst into a flood of tears. I told her about the cats.
I felt it wasn't fair to tell her about Colonel Race, but Suzanne is very sharp. I think she saw there was something more behind. You haven't caught a chill, have you, Anne? Sounds absurd even to suggest such things in this heat. But you keep on shivering. It's nothing, I said. Nerves or someone walking over my grave. I keep feeling something dreadful's going to happen.
Don't be silly, said Suzanne with decision. Let's talk of something interesting, Anne, about those diamonds.
What about them?
I'm not sure they're safe with me. It was all right before. No one could think they'd be amongst my things. But now that everyone knows we're such friends, you and I, I'll be under suspicion too.
Nobody knows they're in a roll of films, though, I argued. It's a splendid hiding place, and I really don't think we could better it.
She agreed doubtfully, but said she would discuss it again when we got to the falls. Our train went at 9 o'clock. Sir Eustace's temper was still far from good, and Miss Pettigrew looked subdued. Colonel Race was completely himself. I felt that I had dreamed the whole conversation on the way back. I slept heavily that night on my hard bunk, struggling with ill-defined menacing dreams. I awoke with a headache and went out on the observation platform of the car. It was fresh and lovely, and everywhere, as far as one could see, were the undulating wooded hills. I loved it. Loved it more than any place I had ever seen. I wished then that I could have a little hut somewhere in the heart of the scrub and live there always. Always. Just before 2:30, Colonel Race called me out from the office and pointed to a bouquet-shaped white mist that hovered over one portion of the bush.
The spray from the falls, he said. We are nearly there.
I was still wrapped in that strange dream feeling of exultation that had succeeded my troubled night. Very strongly implanted in me was the feeling that I had come home. Home. And yet I'd never been here before. Or had I in dreams? We walked from the train to the hotel, a big white building, closely wired against mosquitoes. There were no roads, no houses. We went on the stoop and I uttered a gasp. There, 1/2 mile away, facing us, were the falls. I've never seen anything so grand and beautiful. I never shall.
Anne, you're fey, said Suzanne as we sat down to lunch. I've never seen you like this before.
She stared at me curiously.
Am I? I laughed. But I felt that my laugh was unnatural. It's just that I love it all.
It's more than that. A little frown crossed her brow, one of apprehension.
Yes, I was happy. But beyond that, I had the curious feeling that I was waiting for something, something that would happen soon. I was excited, restless.
After tea, we strolled out, got on the trolley, and were pushed by smiling blacks down the little tracks of rails to the bridge. It was a marvellous sight, the great chasm and the rushing waters below, and the veil of mist and spray in front of us that parted every now and then for one brief minute to show the cataract of water and then closed up again in its impenetrable mystery. That, to my mind, has always been the fascination of the falls, their elusive quality. You always think you're going to see, and you never do. We crossed the bridge and walked slowly on by the path that was marked out with white stone on either side and led round the brink of the gorge. Finally, we arrived in a big clearing where, on the left, a path led downwards towards the chasm.
The Palm Gully, explained Colonel Race. Shall we go down, or shall we leave it until tomorrow? It will take some time, and it's a good climb up again. We'll leave it until tomorrow, said Sir Eustace with decision.
He isn't at all fond of strenuous physical exercise, I have noticed. He led the way back. As we went, we passed a fine native stalking along. Behind him came a woman who seemed to have the entire household belongings piled upon her head. The collection included a frying pan.
I never have my camera when I want it, groaned Suzanne.
That's an opportunity that will occur often enough, Mrs. Blair, said Colonel Race, so don't lament.
We arrived back on the bridge. Shall we go into the Rainbow Forest, he continued, or are you afraid of getting wet? Suzanne and I accompanied him,
Sir Eustace went back to the hotel. I was rather disappointed in the Rainbow Forest. There weren't nearly enough rainbows, and we got soaked to the skin. But every now and then we got a glimpse of the falls opposite and realised how enormously wide they were. Oh, dear, dear falls, how I love and worship you and always shall. We got back to the hotel just in time to change for dinner. Sir Eustace seems to have taken a positive antipathy to Colonel Race. Suzanne and I rallied him gently, but didn't get much satisfaction. After dinner, he retired to his sitting room, dragging Miss Pettigrew with him. Suzanne and I talked for a while with Colonel Race, and then she declared, with an immense yawn, that she was going to bed. I didn't want to be left alone with him, so I got up too and went to my room. But I was far too excited to go to sleep. I did not even undress. I lay back in a chair and gave myself up to dreaming. And all the time I was conscious of something coming nearer and nearer. There was a knock at the door and I started. I got up and went to it. A little black boy held out a note. It was addressed to me in a handwriting I did not know. I took it and came back into the room. I stood there holding it. At last I opened it. It was very short. I must see you. I dare not come to the hotel. Will you come to the clearing by the palm gully? In memory of Cabin 17, please come. The man you knew as Harry Raeburn. My heart beat to suffocation. He was here then. Oh, I had known it. I had known it all along. I had felt him near me. All unwittingly I had come to his place of retreat. I wound a scarf round my head and stole to the door. I must be careful. He was hunted down. No one must see me meet him. I stole along to Suzanne's room. She was fast asleep. I could hear her breathing evenly. Sir Eustace, I paused outside the door of his sitting room. Yes, he was dictating to Miss Pettigrew. I could hear her monotonous voice repeating, I therefore venture to suggest that in tackling this problem of coloured labour. She paused for him to continue, and I heard him grunting something angrily. I stole on again. Colonel Race's room was empty. I did not see him in the lounge, and he was the man I feared most. Still, I could waste no more time. I slipped quickly out of the hotel and took the path to the bridge. I crossed it and stood there waiting in the shadow. If anyone had followed me, I should see them crossing the bridge. But the minutes passed and no one came. I had not been followed. I turned and took the path to the clearing. I took 6 paces or so and then stopped. Something had rustled behind me. It could not be anyone who had followed me from the hotel. It was someone who was already here, waiting. And immediately, without rhyme or reason, and with the sureness of instinct, I knew that it was I myself who was threatened. It was the same feeling as I had had on the Kilmorden that night, a sure instinct warning me of danger. I looked sharply over my shoulder. Silence. I moved on a pace or two. Again I heard that rustle. Still walking, I looked over my shoulder again. A man's figure came out of the shadow. He saw that I saw him and jumped forward, hard on my track. It was too dark to recognise anybody. All I could see was that he was tall and a European, not a native. I took to my heels and ran. I heard him pounding behind. I ran quicker, keeping my eyes fixed on the white stones that showed me where to step, for there was no moon that night, and suddenly my foot felt nothingness. I heard the man behind me laugh, an evil, sinister laugh. It rang in my ears as I fell headlong. Down, down, down to destruction far beneath. Chapter 25. I came to myself slowly and painfully. I was conscious of an aching head and a shooting pain down my left arm when I tried to move, and everything seemed dreamlike and unreal. Nightmare visions floated before me. I felt myself falling, falling again. Once Harry Raeburn's face seemed to come to me out of the mist. Almost I imagined it real, Then it floated away again, mocking me. Once, I remember, someone put a cup to my lips and I drank. A black face grinned into mine. A devil's face, I thought it, and screamed out. Then dreams again. Long, troubled dreams in which I vainly sought Harry Raeburn to warn him. Warn him. What of? I did not know myself. But there was some danger, some great danger, and I alone could save him. Then darkness again, merciful darkness, and real sleep. I woke at last myself again. The long nightmare was over. I remembered perfectly everything that had happened. My hurried flight from the hotel to meet Harry, the man in the shadows, and the last terrible moment of falling. By some miracle or other, I had not been killed. I was bruised and aching and very weak, but I was alive. But where was I? Moving my head with difficulty, I looked round me. I was in a little room with rough wooden walls. On them were huge skins of animals and various tusks of ivory. I was lying on a kind of rough couch, also covered with skins, and my left arm was bandaged up and felt stiff and uncomfortable. At first I thought I was alone, and then I saw a man's figure sitting between me and the light. His head turned towards the window. He was so still that he might have been carved out of wood. Something in the close-cropped black head was familiar to me, but I did not dare to let my imagination run astray. Suddenly he turned and I caught my breath. It was Harry Raeburn. Harry Raeburn in the flesh. He rose and came over to me.
"Feeling better?"
he said a trifle awkwardly. I could not answer. The tears were running down my face. I was weak still, but I held his hand in both of mine. If only I could die like this, whilst he stood there looking down on me, with that new look in his eyes.
"Don't cry, Anne. Please don't cry. You're safe now. No one shall hurt you."
He went and fetched a cup and brought it to me.
"Drink some of this milk."
I drank obediently. He went on talking in a low, coaxing tone, such as he might have used to a child.
"Don't ask any more questions now. Go to sleep again. You'll be stronger by and by. I'll go away if you like."
"No," I said urgently. "No, no."
"Then I'll stay."
He brought a small stool over beside me and sat there. He laid his hand over mine and soothed and comforted. I dropped off to sleep once more. It must have been evening then, but when I woke again the sun was high in the heavens. I was alone in the hut, but as I stirred an old native woman came running in. She was hideous as sin, but she grinned at me encouragingly. She brought me water in a basin and helped me wash my face and hands. Then she brought me a large bowl of soup, and I finished every drop. I asked her several questions, but she only grinned and nodded and chatted away in a guttural language, so I gathered she knew no English. Suddenly she stood up and drew back respectfully as Harry Raeburn entered. He gave her a nod of dismissal and she went out, leaving us alone. He smiled at me.
"Really better today?"
"Yes, indeed, but very bewildered still. Where am I?"
"You're on a small island on the Zambezi, about 4 miles up from the falls."
Do my friends know I'm here?" He shook his head. "I must send word to them."
"That is as you like, of course. But if I were you, I should wait until you are a little stronger."
"Why?" He did not answer immediately, so I went on. "How long have I been here?" His answer amazed me.
"Nearly a month."
"Oh," I cried. "I must send word to Suzanne. She'll be terribly anxious."
"Who is Suzanne?"
"Mrs. Blair. I was with her and Sir Eustace and Colonel Race at the hotel. But you knew that, surely?"
He shook his head. "I know nothing except that I found you caught in the fork of a tree, unconscious and with a badly wrenched arm."
"Where was the tree?"
"Overhanging the ravine. But for your clothing catching on the branches, you would certainly have been dashed to pieces."
I shuddered. Then a thought struck me. "You say you didn't know I was there. What about the note, then?"
"What note?"
"The note you sent me, asking me to meet you in the clearing."
He stared at me. "I sent no note."
I felt myself flushing up to the roots of my hair. Fortunately, he did not seem to notice. "How did you come to be on the spot in such a marvellous manner?" I asked, in as nonchalant a manner as I could assume. "And what are you doing in this part of the world anyway?"
"I live here," he said simply.
"On this island?"
"Yes, I came here after the war. Sometimes I take parties from the hotel out in my boat, but it costs me little to live, and mostly I do as I please."
"You live here, all alone?"
"I'm not pining for society, I assure you," he replied coldly.
"I'm sorry to have inflicted mine upon you," I retorted, "but I seem to have had very little to say in the matter." To my surprise, his eyes twinkled a little.
"None whatever. I slung you across my shoulders like a sack of coal and carried you to my boat, quite like a primitive man of the Stone Age."
"But for a different reason," I put in. He flushed this time, a deep burning blush. The tan of his face was suffused. "But you haven't told me how you came to be wandering about so conveniently for me," I said hastily, to cover his confusion.
"I couldn't sleep. I was restless, disturbed, had the feeling something was going to happen. In the end, I took the boat and came ashore and tramped down towards the falls. I was just at the head of the Palm Gully when I heard you scream."
"Why didn't you get help from the hotel instead of carting me all the way here?" I asked.
He flushed again. "I suppose it seems an unpardonable liberty to you, but I don't think that even now you realise your danger. You think I should have informed your friends? Pretty friends, who allowed you to be decoyed out to death. No, I swore to myself that I'd take better care of you than anyone else could. Not a soul comes to this island. I've got old Bantowney, whom I cured of a fever once, to come and look after you. She's loyal. She'll never say a word. I could keep you here for months and no one would ever know."
"I could keep you here for months and no one would ever know. How some words please one." "You did quite right," I said quietly, "and I shall not send word to anyone. A day or so more anxiety doesn't make much difference. It's not as though they were my own people. They're only acquaintances, really. Even Suzanne. And whoever wrote that note must have known a great deal. It was not the work of an outsider." I managed to mention the note this time without blushing at all.
"If you would be guided by me,"
he said, hesitating. "I don't expect I shall be," I answered candidly, "but there's no harm in hearing."
"Do you always do what you like, Miss Bedingfeld?"
"Usually," I replied cautiously. To anyone else I would have said, "always."
"I pity your husband," he said unexpectedly.
"You needn't," I retorted. "I shouldn't dream of marrying anyone unless I was madly in love with him. And of course, there is really nothing a woman enjoys so much as doing all the things she doesn't like for the sake of someone she does like. And the more self-willed she is, the more she likes it."
"I'm afraid I disagree with you. The boot is on the other leg as a rule," he spoke with a slight sneer.
"Exactly," I cried eagerly, "and that's why there are so many unhappy marriages. It's all the fault of the men. Either they give way to their women, and then the women despise them, or else they are utterly selfish, insist on their own way, and never say thank you. Successful husbands make their wives do just what they want, and then make a frightful fuss of them for doing it. Women like to be mastered, but they hate not to have their sacrifices appreciated. On the other hand, men don't really appreciate women who are nice to them all the time. When I am married, I shall be a devil most of the time, but every now and then, when my husband least expects it, I shall show him what a perfect angel I can be." Harry laughed outright.
"What a cat and dog life you will lead."
"Lovers always fight," I assured him, "because they don't understand each other. And by the time they do understand each other, they aren't in love any more."
"Does the reverse hold true? Are people who fight each other always lovers?"
I don't know," I said, momentarily confused.
He turned away to the fireplace. "Like some more soup?" he asked in a casual tone.
"Yes, please. I'm so hungry that I could eat a hippopotamus."
"That's good."
He busied himself with the fire. I watched. "When I get off the couch, I'll cook for you," I promised.
"I don't suppose you know anything about cooking.
I can warm up things out of tins as well as you can, I retorted, pointing to a row of tins on the mantelpiece.
Touché, he said, and laughed.
His whole face changed when he laughed. It became boyish, happy, a different personality. I enjoyed my soup. As I ate it, I reminded him that he had not, after all, tendered me his advice.
Ah, yes. What I was going to say was this. If I were you, I would stay quietly perdu here until you are quite strong again. Your enemies will believe you dead. They will hardly be surprised at not finding the body. It would have been dashed to pieces on the rocks and carried down with the torrent.
I shivered.
Once you are completely restored to health, you can journey quietly on to Beira and get a boat to take you back to England.
That would be very tame, I objected scornfully.
There speaks a foolish schoolgirl.
I'm not a foolish schoolgirl, I cried indignantly. I'm a woman. He looked at me with an expression I could not fathom as I sat up flushed and excited.
God help me, so you are, he muttered, and went abruptly out.
My recovery was rapid. The two injuries I had sustained were a knock on the head and a badly wrenched arm. The latter was the most serious, and to begin with, my rescuer had believed it to be actually broken. A careful examination, however, convinced him that it was not so, and although it was very painful, I was recovering the use of it quite quickly. It was a strange time. We were cut off from the world, alone together as Adam and Eve might have been, but with what a difference. Old Bantani hovered about, counting no more than a dog might have done. I insisted on doing the cooking, or as much of it as I could manage with one arm. Harry was out a good part of the time, but we spent long hours together lying out in the shade of the palms, talking and quarrelling, discussing everything under high heaven, quarrelling and making it up again. We bickered a good deal, but there grew up between us a real and lasting comradeship, such as I could never have believed possible. That, and something else. The time was drawing near, I knew it, when I should be well enough to leave, and I realized it with a heavy heart. Was he going to let me go? Without a word? Without a sign? He had fits of silence, long moody intervals, moments when he would spring up and tramp off by himself. One evening the crisis came. We had finished our simple meal and were sitting in the doorway of the hut. The sun was sinking. Hairpins were necessities of life with which Harry had not been able to provide me, and my hair, straight and black, hung to my knees. I sat, my chin on my hands, lost in meditation. I felt rather than saw Harry looking at me.
You look like a witch, Anne, he said at last.
And there was something in his voice that had never been there before. He reached out his hand and just touched my hair. I shivered. Suddenly he sprang up with an oath.
You must leave here tomorrow, do you hear? He cried. I can't bear any more. I'm only a man after all. You must go, Anne, you must. You're not a fool. You know yourself that this can't go on.
I suppose not, I said slowly. But it's been happy, hasn't it?
Happy? It's been hell.
As bad as that?
What do you torment me for? Why are you mocking at me? Why do you say that, laughing into your hair?
I wasn't laughing, and I'm not mocking. If you want me to go, I'll go. But if you want me to stay, I'll stay.
Not that, he cried vehemently. Not that. Don't tempt me, Anne. Do you realize what I am? A criminal twice over. A man hunted down. They know me here as Harry Parker. They think I've been away on a trek up country. But any day they may put two and two together, and then the blow will fall. You're so young, Anne, and so beautiful, with the kind of beauty that sends men mad. All the world's before you, love, life, everything. Mine's behind me, scorched, spoiled, with a taste of bitter ashes.
If you don't want me,
you know I want you. You know that I'd give my soul to pick you up in my arms and keep you here, hidden away from the world forever and ever. And you're tempting me, Anne. You with your long witch's hair and your eyes that are golden and brown and green and never stop laughing, even when your mouth is grave. But I'll save you from yourself and from me. You shall go tonight. You shall go to Byra.
I'm not going to Byra, I interrupted.
You are. You shall go to Byra if I have to take you there myself and throw you onto the boat.
What do you think I'm made of? Do you think I'll wake up night after night fearing they've got you?
One can't go on counting on miracles happening. You must go back to England.
Anne, and marry, and be happy.
With a steady man who'll give me a good home.
Better than that. Utter disaster.
And what of you? His face grew grim and set.
I've got my work ready to hand. Don't ask what it is. You can guess, I dare say. But I'll tell you this. I'll clear my name or die in the attempt, and I'll choke the life out of the damn scoundrel who did his best to murder you the other night.
We must be fair, I said. He didn't actually push me over.
He'd no need to. His plan was cleverer than that. I went up to the path afterwards. Everything looked all right, but by the marks on the ground I saw that the stones which outlined the path had been taken up and put down again in a slightly different place. There are tall bushes growing just over the edge. He'd balanced the outside stones on them so that you'd think you were still on the path when in reality you were stepping into nothingness. God help him if I lay my hands upon him.
He paused a minute and then said in a totally different tone,
We've never spoken of these things, Anne, have we? But the time's come. I want you to hear the whole story from the beginning.
If it hurts you to go over the pass, don't tell me, I said in a low voice.
But I want you to know. I never thought I should speak of that part of my life to anyone.